Forrest, do you want to share your toy with Dune?
Sometimes it's hard to have a little brother. Gotta share your dad, gotta share your lover. Gotta share the jam, gotta share the jelly. With a screaming crown of thorns that grew in your mama's belly. All you need to understand can enable is watch them treat your mother like a cow in the stable. And then they start screaming when you're watching Blippi. Turn the other cheek, no, fuck you, hippie.
This is gonna be so much fun.
Mom and dad, what the fuck were you thinking? If life is a stage, then I feel like Abe Lincoln. And just like Honest Abe, I'm gonna tell the truth. Don't wanna take a bath with little John Wilkes Booth. Look at my crib, bitch, don't need another friend.
That's a track from Christy McGill's new album, The Coolest Person on Mars, which is a limited edition orange vinyl dichronium printing from Onzar Delirex Records, which is the Serbian record company that recently caught on fire. This is a personal message to Emmy Tansen. Your shower is ready. That's shower stall five. To the rest of you, welcome. You're listening to the DTFH, a podcast supported by the Wizards of Erectile Tissue over at Blue Chew. Sometimes you'll hear people say with a strange kind of disdain, "Oh, you do boner pill commercials?" Yes, I do. And not only do I do Blue Chew commercials, but also I take Blue Chew tablets because I like having a Jedi-like control over my penis. It makes me happy to know that this is one of the wonderful offerings of science. It has its roots in alchemy, and I'm sure it goes back even further than that. I don't care if it has its roots in the throbbing heart of some demon in the pits of hell. I would still take Blue Chew tablets because they are wonderful. Blue Chew is a unique online service that delivers the same active ingredients as Viagra and Cialis, but in chewable form and at a fraction of the cost. Blue Chew's tablets help men achieve harder, stronger erections to combat all forms of ED, erectile dysfunction. Blue Chew, it's an online prescription service, so no visits to the doctor's office, no awkward conversations, and no waiting in the pharmacy, and it ships right to your door in a discreet package. You won't have to get in one of those awkward, I'm going to take something from my boner conversations. The process is simple. You sign up at BlueChew.com, consult with one of their licensed medical providers, and once you're approved, you'll receive your prescription within days. Don't like swallowing pills? No problem here. Blue Chew's Sildenafil and Tadalafil tablets are chewable. Plus, the ingredients sound like characters from Lord of the Rings. Right now, we got a special deal for our listeners. Try Blue Chew free when you use our promo code Duncan at checkout. You just pay $5 shipping. That's BlueChew.com, promo code Duncan, to receive your first month free. We thank Blue Chew for sponsoring the DTFH. Oh, yeah. Boner pill commercial, but we're back. Hello. How you doing out there, oh perfect being? I know what you're thinking. I'm not perfect. I'm fucked up in some way, probably. Maybe you got some nice secret guilt eating you alive. Specters of the past. Wrathful spirits chewing on your amygdala every day like it was some delicious fairground hot dog. If this isn't possession, I don't know what is. I don't mean literal possession, though it wouldn't surprise me if there was some kind of hyper-technological, futuristic scanning mechanism that could show what dark spirits had attached themselves to your aura. I'm going to have a few. When I was a kid, I tried to jerk off with a Ouija board. It's a long story, maybe for a different podcast. Why wouldn't I have spirits? Why wouldn't any of us have spirits? Have you never gotten stoned and gone to a graveyard? I actually was friends with somebody who ran a graveyard. And one of the big problems of running a cemetery just underneath the screams of the peacocks is you will have to, goths humping on all your graves at night. You got to send somebody through there every 30 minutes just to shake the goths off the graves because they're all on the graves sucking dicks and fucking and getting cum splattered all over the tombs. You got to send someone in the morning with Windex and paper towels to wipe all the goth jizz off your graves. But at some point, you probably got a spirit in you. You probably got some kind of demon in you. Just some creature, some weird psychic entity that likes to float around in your aura. I'm not talking about those things, though. Whenever I consider my demons, I imagine they're probably pretty cool. Not to like pat myself on my astral back or anything like that, but what are we going to do? Like, kick out the demons? Is a tree going to kick out the birds living in it? Do you want your grass to kick out the worms? No. They can hang out in whatever weird psychic biosphere that you've produced by existing itself. I don't think the demons are the problem. If you're one of those people who's really hard on themselves all the time, I would imagine that your demons are probably feeling bad for you. And they're like, geez, you're wonderful. I love living inside of your chakras. It's wonderful in here. It's great. I love eating your fear. Anyway, the point is, if you want to have some fun, if you really want to do something revolutionary, if you really want to like stand in the face of the void and do something that is completely counter to most everything we've been indoctrinated by in the West, just allow yourself a minute, just a minute of imagining that you are perfect. You know how I know you're perfect? Because I got kids now, and my kids are perfect. I love them. They're perfect. They're beautiful, perfect things. And you were one of them once. Yeah, you mutated. You got old. Your hair's falling out. Whatever. You're greasy now. But you're perfect in there. There's a perfect little beautiful, adorable thing that is perfect. That's what you actually are. That's what happens when you die. That's where you go. That's where you already are. You're just like a beautiful, perfect, three-dimensional, temporal entity sticking its way out of the garden of eternity. And something about that creates a phase where you start thinking, I suck. I'm fucking horrible. What are you talking about? Anyway, a minute. That's all you got to do. A minute. It's a game of make-believe. Just pretend with me for a minute that you're perfect. Just see what happens when the alarm systems that have been woven into your consciousness start going off. Oh God, we're doing some kind of weird spiritual thing. No, we're not perfect. What are you talking about? I've got sagging nips and my balls stink. I've got weird ears. My hair's the wrong color. Have you seen my bank account? Do you realize my tax burden? All those alarms. Just forget about them for a second and experience the divine reality that you are perfect. That none of that stuff can affect you at all. Just a minute. Okay, we're back. You can start fucking hating yourself again. That wasn't even a minute, but I just love doing that from time to time just because it's wild how many crazy things I have inside of me that will instantaneously reject that experiment. Try it. Do it every once in a while. Fuck your cool friends who roll their eyes. Just do it every once in a while and see what happens. You might get a tiny little mini vision of paradise and then get this strange swooning sense of like, wait a minute. I almost remembered something. I don't know what that thing is that you almost remembered because I've forgotten it too. But that experiment is well worth doing these days as we enter in to the summer of fucking. By the way, I want to invite all of you to join my Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. I am sad to say that I read, I'm sure you probably read about this. This is actually, well, I have nothing to do with it, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, I guess like a few people have been getting attacked by like mid-sized animals now, not just little ones anymore. And my attorneys, again, they just want me to say, obviously, that I have no way, I have no control over this. And there is no connection between people who subscribe to my Patreon and people who haven't been attacked by animals, formerly small animals like chipmunks and squirrels. Now I'm hearing about like mid-sized animals. It's no longer like these like annoying bites. Maybe you got to get a rabies shot. Now, I guess like some people were attacked by hyenas, and a monitor lizard apparently snapped off a few fingers from somebody. Look, I have nothing to do with it. It's not a threat. Obviously, it'd be crazy if I was saying, which I'm not, that like we do have a device here that like essentially sends out pulses that make animals aggressive to people who aren't on my Patreon. That'd be nuts. But if I did have a thing like that, and I suddenly realized that it was kind of like beginning to control bigger animals that could potentially like maim someone, or even worse, and then I realized that I can't unplug it because it doesn't have a plug. It's just this glowing stone somebody gave me when I was on a hike. That would be bad, actually. I'd probably be freaking out a lot about that because I really initially didn't want anyone to get more than like a little nip, like a cute little, it's cute, like a chipmunk. And not that they told me this, but if they did tell me, like in whatever this is, I'm not saying they actually said it, but it could be that they may have said, look, don't worry. Yeah, this, it'll only do little animals. And then they went back into the woods and gave me this stone. I don't know how to turn it off is what all I'm saying. It doesn't exist, but if it did exist, I don't know how to turn it off. And it seems to be affecting bigger animals now. So please subscribe to my Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. You're going to get commercial-free episodes of this podcast. You are not going to get a guarantee that you won't be attacked by these animals that are getting bigger. And I mean, how big could it even go is the thing. I should have, what if it starts affecting bears? But it doesn't matter. That's all just silly gobbledygook, gobbledygook, gobbledygook. If you go to patreon.com/DTFH, you will be able to hang out with us 2 times a week. And by us, I mean your DTFH family. An assortment of some of the most brilliant, revolutionary, spiritual geniuses that ever plodded upon the sweet land. They're all waiting for you, your family, at patreon.com/DTFH. All right, friends, with us here today is the brilliant Chris Gethard. Maybe you've seen his awesome show, The Chris Gethard Show. Maybe you've read some of his great books. He's got a new comedy special coming out called Half My Life. It's coming out on June 1st on Amazon Prime Video, Apple TV, Peacock, and many other streaming services. He also co-hosts his podcast, New Jersey is the World, and he is doing an upcoming stand-up tour along with a tour of his other podcast, which is fucking awesome, Beautiful Anonymous. You got to check it out. He just has these sometimes very poignant conversations with anonymous people. He is a wonderful person, and it was really a joy to get to spend this hour or so chatting with him. So everybody, please welcome to the DTFH, Chris Gethard. Did you ever think you'd have a kid?
I wondered for a very long time. I was not necessarily a very stable person for a lot of my life. And I was really worried about passing on that mental instability. It's like still my great fear. But I remember, I wish I remembered who said this to me, because I was once expressing this, you know, once I started hitting my mid-30s, later 30s, start to think about it, talk about it with some friends. And a friend of mine was like, no, you don't understand. Like, if your kid ever suffers from the same stuff you do, you're never going to judge him. Like, he's never going to be scared to talk to you. Right. And I was like, oh, that's eye opening, you know, like, which I think is true for any parent, no matter what the deal is. It's like, if you've been through something hard and you're praying your kid doesn't go through it, of course, I hope that's the case, but it's going to go a lot better for them than it went for you, because you've got that empathy now and you've got that open door now. And that made me realize maybe this is something I want to try, you know?
Do you feel like you weren't able to talk to your folks about some of the stuff you grappled with?
No, for sure. That's another thing that popped into my head that I was interested in asking you about, as I realized we're so in tune on this. Like, my relationship with my own parents has very much changed, especially my dad. I understand my dad a lot more now. And I also am kind of, I have to resist feeling some jealousy about the way he treats my son compared to how I was raised. Like, the grandparent role, very different. And it's hard not to go, where the hell were you my whole childhood? This cuddly soft man rolling around on the floor.
Yeah.
My parents were incredible, but I mean, like, hard, you know, hard working people. My mom's parents were immigrants. My dad was the hardest working person I've ever known. His whole thing is like, you work hard and solve your shit. And that's cool. And I get some elements of that that work well for me. And then other times where I always felt maybe very vulnerable opening up, you know, like I remember I've broken a bone once in my life. And this tells you a lot. This tells you a lot. My brother and I were wrestling on our front lawn and he landed on me and his knee broke my left collarbone in half.
Holy shit.
So I was like screaming on the front lawn. And my mom came out and was like, what are you yelling about now? I said, I think I broke my shoulder. She goes, you did not. You're always being a baby. And it was Super Bowl Sunday. We wound up going over to this other family we're friends with to their house. And me and my brother got in another fight. And it was a few hours later. And my parents saw us fighting and went, Chris isn't swinging with his left. I think something really is wrong. Wow. Like that's how they knew, like, it, well, everything was like, tough it out, you know? And that wasn't just them. That was growing up in the 80s and 90s. That was growing up in a blue collar neighborhood. That was growing up in a family that wasn't too far removed from getting off the boat. Like, all those factors, a lot of it's just, you be tough, you handle it. And I always laugh at that one of like, the only reason they believed I broke a bone was because in the next fight, I was be hobbled.
See, oh yeah. Well, do you, for me, when I'm looking back on what these days would basically be called neglect, like if your parents had been one of these, like, you know, any variety of social media family, there's a million of them. And that was something they were filming, you know, and they were like, oh, he really did break his call. Oh, shit, he's not swinging. Can't, that's an insta cancel. That's like, yeah, probably Child Protective Services is going to get involved too.
No fucking way.
When I think of, like, you know, we go to the pool with my kid now and I'm like, you know, now I don't take my eye off of him. Because he's just learned, this is, I don't know, have you gone swimming a lot with your kid yet?
Yeah, yeah. He loves the water.
My child has just figured out how to jump into the pool, but he doesn't know how to swim. So it's like the worst possible combination. You gotta watch. But when I was a kid, his age, probably younger, they just put the fucking floaties on you and push you out of the ocean. Not the ocean, I'm sorry, the pool. The ocean, even my parents didn't do that. But you know what I mean? Like, I remember I was floating in the pool and a kid pulled, like some kid just swam up to me, a little fucking pool bully, and pulled out the thing that holds the air in.
And tried to kill you, tried to drown you.
Watching like some kind of serial killer as I'm looking at the thing going out of air, trying to signal to my mom, she's not looking at me. The point is, we are in different times. A lot of us are raising our kids differently. Is it bad? You think it's bad? Should we? Are we being too soft on our children?
I don't think so. I think a lot about it because I take a lot of value in how I grew up. But I just moved back to New Jersey where I grew up. I was in New York City for 16 years, and I've been reconnecting a lot with a lot of people I grew up with. And I always figured, like, you know, like, we're in entertainment. Our job is to exaggerate to a degree. Our job is to boil it down to the interesting parts and just hammer those, right? And so I'm always like, I'm probably remembering this wrong. It probably wasn't as intense as I remember. Everyone I grew up with is like, yeah, it was dark, man. It was dark and weird and hard. And so many of my friends who are like, I've spent years unwrapping it. Like, I was born in 1980, and people around that time remember, like, we literally, there were like pictures of kidnapped kids on milk cartons, and we stared at them. Every time you had milk, you stared at a kidnapped child.
Oh, fuck. And
you know, and your parents would just, you'd get home from school and they'd be like, go ride your bike and go somewhere.
Yeah.
I don't want you in the house. Come back by 6 for dinner. Also, there's probably, you know, and then everything you hear is rumors about Satanists and
yeah,
molesters. Like, everything was like dark and they had us so scared. So I don't want that for my kid. I don't think that that's soft for him to not have that. I also do take some value, and I think, especially for like a mild-mannered emotional guy, actually have to keep wanting to pursue a career where you never get health insurance. Being a comedian's not hard. Like, I'm not a coal miner, but it's uncertain.
Yeah.
There's stress. I got to be tough on some level. And the way I keep thinking of it is, I'm like, I don't want my son getting in fights. I got in too many fights growing up. I want him to know how to fight. And the way I keep thinking of it is, I'm like, I want him to know how to fight. So if he ever comes around a corner and sees some kid getting beat up by 3 nasty kids, he can get on that guy's team. You know what I mean? Yeah. I want him to be able to step up when he has to, but I just don't want him to have to all that often.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know how you feel. One's a lot to unwrap.
It's a lot to unwrap. Well, I always feel like I have to be careful because I had a PTSD Vietnam dad. So if I, you know, so I have to watch out because I'm going to overcompensate in the other direction. And then I'm not going to give him what any toddler needs, which is like actual structure. You don't get to be their friend. You've got to like tell them what's safe and what isn't. And just what you're saying, you know, get them ready for a world that is, whether they're comics or not, uncertain. By the way, that does make me think, is there some like dad part of you that watches him or listens to the way his sense of humor or like thinks I would like him to be a comedian?
I mean, that it's like there's a part of me that's like anything but this, like,
yeah,
especially right now where it feels like comedy's getting kind of like more cliquish than it's been in the time I've been doing it. And people actually seem kind of like angry at each other. And you start to see like, oh, it's like so weird. It's always been a weird culture to be a part of. And it's starting to feel like very much so now. But then there's also a part of me that goes, he makes me laugh for real. And he knows he's trying to make me laugh and he's doing it.
Yeah.
And not even, there are times where I'm not in the mood to laugh. Like, I'm not sitting there trying to connect with him that way. And he'll make me laugh. And I go, man, how cool is it? How cool would it be to just have a funny kid and see him go for it and do it? Like, there's a part of me that thinks it would be real cool. And then there's a part of me that's like, because my wife's an artist too. So I'm also like, man, maybe he'll just like want to be a black sheep and rebel against us, which in our house means he'd have to go like get a stable salary job with a 401k.
I know.
And security. And
that's the rebellion we're going to get. That's what we're going to get. Probably. I mean, if you just look at the way kids push back, like I didn't want to be a comedian. I just ended up being a comedian. I don't know. It was all just some trying to get away from my folks. And then, you know, just, I got lucky, but I wanted to, this is kind of diverging from the kid talk. I think it's really interesting that you married the head musician on your show.
Yeah.
My podcast is generally not like some kind of gross TMZ inquisition or some shit like that.
But I was just thinking, how did that go down? Like, how did the romance start? What season did it start? And did you try to hide it from people in the beginning?
The wild part is that she was in a band that I genuinely loved years before I ever met her. I was a legitimate fan. She's in this punk band called The Unlovables. She wrote all the songs, sang them, and they're great, like great songs. And had the album, bought it at the Virgin Megastore, and really admired her, and had seen her live a couple times, and just thought she was so cool. And then back in the day, so my old talk show started at UCB. It was like a midnight show, and it was a really hot ticket, and it was real. I look back, I go, that show was dark, and like violent, and then like, but interesting, and like breaking the fourth wall, and part times where the audience was like, I don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
And she was the house band at that time, was all these friends of hers from the punk world, and they used to sneak her into the show, because it would be sold out pretty regularly. And I started realizing, that's Hallie Unlovable. She's here watching this show. Mm-hmm. So she kind of knew my comedy. I knew her music. And there's a funny story. One time I wound up naked on stage hosting the show due to some dumb bit gone wrong.
Wow. And I'm sorry, accidentally naked? Like, you didn't know you would be naked before the show?
We were doing this thing called the Telethon of Shame. We were raising money for the March of Dimes. The whole idea was, we're going to have all these like fucked up things, and if the crowd kicks in enough money, it'll trigger those things.
Oh, wow.
So like, and it was wild, man. Like, people would be shocked, because I think I have this reputation as this like emo guy and this nice guy, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. But also, like, I've had some stretches that were dark. Like, one of the things was like a guy ate a hot dog out of another guy's butthole. Like, really dark. A guy drank his own pee. Like, it was like the telethon of shame. Like, everything was shameful. I said, $500, I'll host the rest of the show with no clothes on.
Wait, man, you know what you just said? You just said a guy ate a banana.
A hot dog
out of his own butthole.
Out of someone else's butthole.
Okay, I'm sorry. Because what happened is my brain was trying to process all
this. Yes,
and somewhere in there, I did a fake, like, yeah. The way I said it was like, yeah, of course. Like that old stage act where you put the hot dog in the butt.
So they had the hot dog, and when it hit the monetary value.
What was the monetary value?
I forget. It was high, though, because that was one of the craziest ones. It was high.
Over 1,000?
Probably 500 or 600.
Okay.
This guy, the one guy, pulled down his pants. He laid down on a table face down. The other guy took out some witch hazel that he bought at the drugstore and some cotton balls, and he sanitized his asshole. And then he placed the hot dog. He didn't put it up his butt like a dildo. He placed it in between the cheeks, like the cheeks were a hot dog bun.
Cool. That makes
sense. And then he ate it out of that, like his butt cheeks were a hot dog bun. And he,
I don't think, I mean, witch hazel, huh? Like, is that going to really work? That seems like a kind of old wives tale.
I have no idea why he didn't go with rubbing alcohol. It seems like a safer bet, but that was actually the most degrading part. I guess that's true. But you don't want to eat witch hazel either.
Not butt and butt. Germs, like sweaty, like you're nervous. Cause if that's happening to me, I'm going to be nervous. Like, if someone's eating a hot dog on my butt on stage, it's going to be a sweaty.
And there's hot lights on you. It was really disturbing. And there were like a bunch of disturbing things that happened in that show. But I always justify, because we raised $9,000 for the March of Dimes in like an hour and a half at at like a little theater. So in the course of that show, where all this completely horrible stuff is happening, I'm naked. I turn around. I see Hallie sitting behind the drum set because the band snuck her in, and that's where she sat. And we made eye contact. And she says that I just looked at her and went, oh, no, you're here. And then got back to hosting the show. And that's the first time we spoke. So then their singer, when we switched over to being a public access TV show, their singer left for Canada, so they need a new singer. They brought her in. She wound up being on the show for like 7 or 8 years. And we were a public access TV show for 200 episodes, and that thing was a labor of love. And I think a lot of us felt like there was something special happening. And it's wild because, like, I have another friend who was on the show. He proposed to his girlfriend on the show on public access TV. I was the reverend at his wedding. He was the reverend at mine. Another two cast members of the show are married. They're about to have their third kid.
Yeah.
We had our first kid. I have another friend. Like, I can think of another guy who met his wife on the show. And a whole bunch of people. Actually, yeah, probably five or six married couples that met through the show. So, you know, it was a public access show. So it wasn't some, like, serious thing of, like, oh, you're dating the band leader. That's scandal. It was more just, like, we all really feel like we're on to something here. And I think when you get in, like, a collective environment like that, that really feels like everybody's on the same page. You're hanging out all the time outside of the show. And it was much more organic than, like, scandalous.
I love what you said on Nikki Glaser's podcast, that you had this realization, the whole of, like, comedian pursuit of the sitcom thing was to feed your own ego. And it wasn't even something you wanted to do.
Yeah.
You'd gotten vacuumed up into that classic LA trap where people just look at what has been successful for other people. You try to replicate that. If you get on a show, you realize this is never what I wanted to do. And I just thought it was really beautiful, man, because you decided to just dive into public access and listen to what your own heart wanted you to do, I'm assuming. And look what it did. It brought a kid into the universe.
It's true. I look at the kid, I go, it's all worth it. Because, you know, I do have insecurity. I do wonder, you know, I had an agent who soured on me and kind of gave up on me because every year I'm going, I don't want to go to pilot season. Yeah. I want to stay here and do a public access TV show. And they're going, what are you talking about? Like, it's public access TV, but I just knew I was onto something. And sometimes I still wonder, would I be more, I'm sure you feel the same way, especially having a kid now. I have a kid, a mortgage. I go, some stability would be nice.
Right.
I am very proud of everything I've done and I've gotten to live a cool life, but this pandemic year is the first year in like 15 years that I didn't get health insurance through one of the guilds. And I just go, well, there's not going to be another pandemic, I hope, for, you know, the last one was 100 years ago. But that was eye-opening. It was eye-opening to go, oh, I had 1 year where things went really wrong and now I got to scramble and try to get health insurance again. Like, that's scary with a kid. So sometimes I go, man, maybe I should have done the more traditional stuff. And then I step back and go, I think the stuff I did was, like, cooler and more me. And I've never managed to bust out in a big way. Even when we got to True TV, it was their lowest rated show, I think, ever.
Okay.
But the people who did like it loved it. You know, the people who did find it loved it.
You have the fever. And all comics get it. And I remember I used to be the talent coordinator of the Comedy Store. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I'm sorry if it sounds like that. You got the plague, man. But you do. I remember when I first got the Comedy Store, young comic, talent coordinator. And I remember talking to one of the Sklar brothers and sincerely saying to him, how does it feel to have made it? And he goes, what are you talking about? You know, like, we haven't made it. What is that? What do you even mean? And, like, you know, my wife, I told her I was interviewing you and she was like, holy shit, how'd you get an interview with him? And, you know, and so that's the funny thing is I think what's weird about the job is that you end up having all these successes that other people look at and think, my God.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, that's an apex comic. That's a comic who's had, you know, three seasons of his show. And before that, like a public access show, which, by the way, public access show is a fucking show. Attaching the access thing is so weird anyway. But all I'm saying is, when will you feel, you know, when will you feel like, okay, I did it?
Well, one of the greatest things that ever happened to me is years ago, I had caught some momentum. It was starting to move. It hadn't broken yet. But I was in a green room at the UCB in New York. And there were two guys off in a side room. And they didn't realize I had arrived. And they were talking loud. I wasn't trying to eavesdrop. And one of them's going, man, I don't know if I'm going to get fired. I'm not sure what to do next if I backed myself into a corner. The other guy's going, yeah, you know, I'm trying to figure out, should I move my family from LA? Because if they get here and then I get fired, I'm going to have to move them back in the school year and this and that. And I'm listening to these two guys, and one of them was on Saturday Night Live at the time and like years deep into a great run. The other guy was a correspondent on The Daily Show at that moment. And I had to, I was so sad for their stress. I'm not saying I like that they were stressed, but I sat there and went, I figured those are the jobs that put out the fire. And I had this moment where I went, no job is ever going to make me feel better. A professional accomplishments don't do it. Like there's some things about me that are broken and jobs aren't going to fix them. Yeah. So I got to get that out of my head and I got to find some other ways to fix them that are more about who I actually am as a human. Cause it's just very, it's very tied into like capitalism and this idea. One of the things right now that I've really had to take a deep breath on is like 2016 and 2017 for me, I had a TV show, I got a book deal, I had an HBO special, my podcast blew up. So all these things happened within like 18 months of each other. So I made more money than I ever made. And now, right now, I'm making about 1/6 of what I made in 2017.
Yeah.
And then I take a step back. I go, this is a pretty healthy living I'm making today. If that 2-year stretch never happened, I'd be thrilled. But in America, we are trained from the jump to go, oh, if you make less this year than you made last year, you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
I don't buy that, but it's hard not to feel it, you know?
Yeah.
To go, oh, man, I'm making like 18% of what I made 5 years ago. And I say, because 5 years ago, your life went insane. Your life went insane 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's another thing to loop it back to having a kid is I've had all these really beautiful moments with him because I was a real workaholic too and just go, figure it out. And then I got this new house and I spent all the TV show money on the house, you know, and it's a pretty nice neighborhood. Now we're like the poorest people in the neighborhood because I made the money and I can buy the house and now I got to try to keep the house. And it's in a great school district and I play with my son in our yard. And like I mow the lawn and he gets out his toy lawnmower and he thinks he's helping me.
Yes.
And that's the type of thing where I go, you got to remember that this is why you fought so hard for so long.
Yeah.
Not so you could be famous. Not so you could have more money than you had last year. The reason you fight hard is to watch your son push a fake lawnmower on the lawn. And that sounds cheesy. I know.
No, it doesn't. Not to me.
I really think a lot of us would just be really well served to redefine the conversation about success and money and how they relate to each other and how they relate to happiness. Because over and over again, I'm like, I stress so much. I step back and go, man, I had my TV show and that special and I wrote 3 books. And I did this and that. And that was all before I was 40. And then I'm going to sit here and still feel bad. Fuck that. Like, that's because of money. That's because of ego. There's something wrong with a system that induces that much stress in a situation like that.
Oh, my God. You know that you listen to the right wingers, you know, bugling about how communism wants to destroy the family. But when you think about what capitalism naturally does to a lot of families, which is it instills that thing you're talking about in one or both parents, they go out into the world, drop their kids off at some whatever they could afford, and if they don't live near their parents, and they don't get the lawnmower time. They don't get that at all. It's a special occasion if they find themselves having an extended, meaningful time with their kids. And so that to me is, I hear you. And I think we're feeling it. I think collectively that realization is bubbling up in a lot of us, which is, what the fuck is the point? Is the point to like just get infinite amounts of money, when my experience with that sort of success has been cliche as it can get, which is like, what do you know? It didn't do anything. I still feel as disturbed as I felt when I was living in a fucking roach motel with roaches crawling on my face. It was, oh, it didn't work. The thing, like, literally, and on every, on walls of beach houses, money won't make you happy, or what, that classic thing. When you really experience it, it's a little unnerving, but you know, it's unnerving when you really, when you understand that at any level, it just is like, fuck, then what? Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I feel lucky that I made money. I feel lucky that it allowed me to buy this house. Like, yeah. I understand the benefit. I don't want to sit here and be like, I'm talking in one breath about how I bought a nice house, and the next breath about how money is like a thing that causes nothing but insecurity and pain. Like, I get that that's trying to have it both ways, but I do think that there's a lot of value in knowing when to say, like, enough is enough, and I might be there, and maybe I'm allowed to like enjoy plateauing it right here and not having to kill. Not, I don't want to work until I have a heart attack and drop dead. I don't want to do it. I love going on the road. I love it so much, but like, I don't need to go out 150 days a year and not see my kid for half the year. You know, like, I don't want to die in a fucking La Quinta Inn on the side of a highway in Fort Worth, Texas. You know, like, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. Like, so I'll make less money. I'll tour less. I'll go out tour 25% less. I'll make 25% less money from my touring schedule. And that's okay.
Floating into the void with all these other touring comics who happen to die on the same night as you, like, mournfully waving at each other as you go into whatever the next thing is. I get it. I mean, yeah, I think that there I mean, I love touring too. Yeah, there's no way that I'm going to do anything like that ever again with my kid. I'm not going to do that. I mean, if I do it, I'm going to figure out a way to bring them with me. But look, have you seen that new, this sounds like a complete bullshit non sequitur. Have you seen that new Pink documentary?
I have not.
My
wife loves Pink. My wife was just saying earlier today, no joke, we got to see Pink live sometime. And I was like, what? Where is this coming from?
We were just on a beach vacation and somehow we ended up watching a music award show, which, talk about, like, for me, I'm 47. For me, that was just like, okay, I am definitely not cool anymore. Like, I don't know any. I just found out about the fucking Weeknd. My wife was telling me, like, it's like, oh, I've heard the song. Actually, it's pretty good. Yeah, I think he's got a shot. But yeah, so we're watching Pink. And my wife was like, I love Pink. She teared up a little bit. And I had to, you know, swallow down whatever my stupid my Pink opinion or whatever. Cause like, how am I going to judge someone who's doing like trapeze acts while like, belting out music in key? Like, so then we watched the documentary and the very beginning of it. And we stopped just cause like, and no offense to Pink or that way of being, but it just starts off just taking her kid to Paris. Her family's there. And she just said to her kid, maybe you'll get a music agent or maybe you'll get a record deal. And it hurt me because you want your kid to get a record deal? Like, that's a kid.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want a record deal for the kid. I think she's joking a little bit or whatever. But you know what I'm saying? I think that is what if you want to be the parent that continues the career, it's either separate from your kids or take them on the road with you on your tours and stuff. And that seems kind of tough on a kid.
Yeah. I'm trying to go out like not more than 3 days in a row, maybe once or twice a month, and just do the math, right? Here's how much my mortgage and bills are. Here's how much I'm making from other things. Here's how much the road should do and just make it all about the kid. You know, it's, I think it's funny to, I think about it, like you're saying about that with Pink and how weird it feels to say the music contract. Do we want our kids to be comedians? And I sit around and I go, I get like giddy thinking about all the options. Like, cause my wife is an artist too. And I'm one of the rare comedians I know where her career is actually so weird that I'm the more normal one. I've had the more normal career doing what I do. And I did I earlier described a show where a man ate a hot dog out of another man's asshole on stage. Like, and I have had the more normal career. So I sit there, I go, maybe he'll be like the weirdest artist ever. Maybe he'll turn around and be like, I want to be a welder. I want to get a union card and be a welder. And I'm like, I get giddy thinking about either option. You know, yeah. Like, that's, you want to be an electrician? Or do you want to go be a circus clown? Like, I'm so psyched to see what it turns into. How do you feel? I don't think I asked you about the kid in comedy question.
Oh, yeah. I can't. Anything he does I think is funny or that seems like, oh, shit. Like, just what you're saying. Like, you are definitely. Like, he was at his grandmother's house, and there was a monkey on the screen, and he pointed to the monkey and said, that's daddy. Wow. You know, I heard about that. But that is really, really, really funny to me. That. And then when I asked him about it, I'm like, did you say that I was a monkey to Nana? And he goes, he looks at me and he goes, no. Like, it was awesome. Just what you would do with a smile on his face. The uh-huh. point, yes. But you know, no, I don't, I mean, like, I feel like part of the parent I want to be is just what you're talking about, which is not hanging some role on them, but, you know, listening to what they like and trying to tune into that as much as I can. Cause you know, I think it's brutal. If like, and really like pretty musty to like try to get your kid to do whatever you do. I mean, that's almost as unoriginal as you can get. Yeah. Parents, like, name, no offense if you did, but naming your child after yourself, you know, what is that?
I did not do that.
Is this an echo of me? Am I sending just me's down through time? I want you, one thing I love about your comedy is that you have, you're definitely just doing your own thing. And that's not a diss on any other comics, but you have gone your own way and you've made it work.
And for better or for worse. Yes.
For my perspective, for better, because, and I know that's a secondary consideration to your perspective because you're you.
I know. I think for better overall. Yeah. Overall. Yeah.
Better. Cause we have you, we have your art out there. And also it's like, you know, I think a lot of people need to see that you can make it happen with what you've got. You don't need to like fit into the stereotypical, whatever the thing may be, you know, and that you can do a public access show that does get success and that you can listen to your own heart and end up in a nice house that you bought with money from your art. I mean, that's fucking nuts, man.
I take a deep breath and I understand how hard I worked and I understand how lucky I am. And outside of any stress or stereotypical comedian anxiety, I go, I took this further than I thought I would. And that's a beautiful thing.
But I want to know if you wrestled with, I think this was your third book, you published it in 2018. I want to know if you wrestled with writing a self-help book, like if you felt this isn't what a comedian does.
I'm going to tell you something that I do not think has gone on record publicly yet, which is, so I did my HBO special about depression and a publishing company came to me and said, we want to publish the book version of it. And I said, you know what? I've been kind of living in this. I've been working on this show for a bunch of years. I did it off Broadway
And then I did it at that Edinburgh Festival, another HBO special. I'm getting messages about it all the time. I said, it's really flattering, but I don't want to live in the depression forever. I don't want to be the depression guy, and I don't want to commodify it any further. Wow. Like, I think I've said what I want to say about it, and it was hard. And then they turned around and said, well, we'll let you write about whatever you want for the same amount of money we offered.
Wow.
And it was, they were self-help imprint. And it was a constant struggle for me to figure out how to balance it needing to be self-help because of who they were while trying to turn it into something I like. And I don't think it landed 100%.
Mm.
But I'll tell you another thing. This is the part that nobody knows, and it's kind of dark, which is, it's the only career choice I've ever made where the money was the priority.
Mm.
And I've made money off of other things, and I'm happy about it. But like the TV show, we were on public access for years, and I had situations where like one network told me, if you fire the rest of the cast and hire, like, basically the short end of what they were saying was, if you hire hotter people than your friends, I was like, nope, I don't care how much you're offering me. So I'd stood my ground on some things like this, but I had a situation where there was a family member of mine who had a series of mounting and really severe medical bills.
Yeah.
And it was an amount of money where I went, this will allow me to help solve a situation that has been very bad and is getting worse. Mm. So I sit there and sometimes I go, man, because the book didn't sell well. I think for a lot of people who are my fans up until then, that book maybe in their eyes was when I jumped the shark a little bit for some of the old school, like public access punk rock vibe fans.
Did you get feedback that said that? You got some punk rock fans saying, what's going on with this book?
Well, the title of it was Lose Well, which is a phrase that kind of said randomly one night on my TV show about like, our job is not to figure out how to be winners, because everybody, like, we're a public TV show, we're clearly losers, so let's just get good at that and lose well. And I saw some people going, man, like, I have that phrase tattooed on my body and now it's the title of a self-help book, you know? And I'm like, I screwed up. I should have named it something else, because I should have known what this was. But I knew myself, and I'd always managed to step up. But it was in the middle of a couple of years where there was so much happening professionally in front of the scenes, and then behind the scenes, this family situation that was hard, brutal. Like, I can just say brutal. I don't want to get into too many details, but it was brutal. And it was brutal based on what the situation itself was. And then you turn around and go, and it's also bleeding you dry financially.
Yeah.
So it's hard to regret taking the shot. And I really thought that I could have turned that book into something more, but then it hit the publication date and I went, I think it's like 80% where I want it to be, and now there's nothing I can do about it. And it stresses me out. And
good, it's all God.
'Cause a lot of it is because of the self-help thing, you know, it would not necessarily have been something I would not have pitched a book, but they gave me an open deal. I would not have pitched self-help, and I really thought I could have found out a cool way to do it, and I don't think I solved the puzzle.
Well,
okay. I have some regrets.
May I was two things that popped in my head. Number one, you can't be in charge of the consequences of someone else getting a fucking tattoo of something you said. Yeah. They got that. Yeah. What are you going to do? Get like a registry of everyone who's got that tattooed on their arm and do a poll about whether you got the tattoo. Look, you have a Morrissey
Tattoo. I gotta get that one covered soon, man.
Hey, I mean, come on. It's like, you know, it's not Morrissey's fault. You know, he did the thing where you get a little older and like start saying shit where people are like, what the fuck? You can't say that.
Yeah.
You've had the same experience. Now people see Morrissey on your arm and they're like, oh wow. So
proud boy, you fucking proud boy, dude. Like,
boy, you like Morrissey? Who would have thought? You didn't know that. Now, I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. What's the phrase that it takes strength to be gentle and kind? I think is the other tattoo that I've. Wow, that's one of my favorite Morrissey lines. Anyway, and you know, I just feel like with that sort of thing, if we don't learn that people reincarnate in a single lifetime, then we're eventually gonna have nothing that we enjoy, you know, like I don't know, I think it's beautiful you wrote a self-help book, and I hope that didn't stop you from writing anymore.
No, it scared me a little bit. Because like I said, it was not a bullseye.
Yeah.
And I've always been okay keeping things small if it means that I can feel like I nailed it, even if the world doesn't think I nailed it.
Yeah.
And that was a situation where they wanted to go big and they wanted it to be a certain thing. But like I said, creatively, I have some regrets. But I think if anybody knew the backstory of, there was this fucked up situation and that money solved the situation, you go, ultimately, that is much more important than if I wrote a book that bombed, you know? And the other thing that I learned too is the editor of the book was so kind, such a nice guy, had my back hard, and I will be indebted to him forever and I'm a fan of his. But when you're a comedian or when you're hosting the TV show with the live audience, you are used to collective feedback guiding you. Yeah. When you're writing a book, it's your instincts and then that one editor's reaction.
Yeah.
And one thing I realized is that all of his priorities working there were the self-help and the balance of comedy it wasn't his concern. So then they pushed and pulled at each other.
Yeah.
And some people really enjoyed the book and say they've gotten a lot out of it. That makes me feel good, but I did feel weird about it. I have a lot of as you can tell, this answer tripped me up more than you expected it to, for sure.
I was talking to my friend, she's a very successful author, and I was trying to write and I'm like, do you ever feel like your idea for a book is totally wrong? Like the thing that you've committed to writing is just completely wrong. And she's like, I'm going on a book tour and I feel like that about my book now.
Yeah.
You know? So I wonder if it's just a universal sense of like, I don't know. I mean, you've written two other books, so maybe you felt better about the other two and this just didn't hit the spot. But you know, my friend, he's got this whole podcast about like how if you want to, like, for any artist that has achieved any true renown has had to have a public stinker. Like you can't, and by the way, I'm not saying that was your book, but I think, isn't that kind of the path? Because I didn't read the book. I just
good.
Forgive me if that seemed like some weird backhanded thing.
Oh no, at all. I'm the one who laid out all my feelings on it. You have nothing to apologize for.
I think it's a beautiful thing because that's the kind of book I don't have the guts. You're so brave, man. I think like doing a thing like that takes guts. Where you're like, no, I'm not gonna write the funny fucking thing. You know what I mean? I'm not gonna write the thing. It's whatever, the bubbly funny thing. I'm gonna try to write this kind of book, and it is going to upset people, and there are going to be comedians and old fans or whatever like, what the fuck, what are you now, is this who you are now? But you do it anyway, and yeah, maybe it didn't, maybe it's not going to work, but to me, who cares if you did it?
Thanks, man. Thanks, that's super nice, makes me feel better. And you know what, as I've never realized this before, But when you said the other two books, do I feel differently about them? I do. But I also, the one book was like through this company. It's the weirdest, it's one of the great things that's ever happened in my life. When I was 19 years old, there's a magazine where I grew up in New Jersey, this underground magazine called Weird New Jersey that's all about haunted shit in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And it was two guys who owned it, and they hired me as their only employee. And it just kept getting bigger, and it led to me co-writing the Weird US book with them, and I wrote the Weird New York book with them, and that was my first book. And that's a company that I like got in the trenches and fought for. My second book, from the time I started writing it till when it was published, it was 7 years. And most of those years were just getting rejected by everybody and me going, no, I know it's good. Every situation I've ever been in that has gone well is one that nobody believed in for a long time first. But when somebody comes and says, whatever you want it to be, here's a pile of money.
Yeah.
I got cast in a sitcom in 2010 before all the public access stuff. Nope, not good. Anything I've ever done where somebody goes, dude, we got you. Here's, even when my show went to cable, it was like, and now life's going to get easier. Nope, got harder. I don't react well to people opening doors to me. I am at my best when I feel like I have to like kick open a door that they've locked. Like that's, for some reason, I don't know if it actually goes better then or if it just feels like it does, but I tend to stumble when people actually try to make it comfortable and smooth for me. And I'm only realizing this right now that there's a consistent pattern there.
Yeah. It's like you're one of those people who wants to run with a weighted vest for some reason. At one point when in my meditation practice had this like realization that I am associating how much it hurts to sit still in an uncomfortable position, to not scratch itches, to like be too rigid. I realized I'm associating that with success meditating, which is like, what, how do you succeed at meditating anyway? That's so ridiculous. But then I realized, oh yeah, your meditation is like a fractal for your whole life. And then I realized, fuck, if I'm not hurting, I think I'm failing. If there's not, what a terrible consideration. But it's like,
that's a huge realization, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, so when things are easy, maybe it's because of the what, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's because of our parents. Maybe it's just because of the way the route we took into comedy or whatever. But I know other comics like it too, who get really scared when shit's easy, and they feel like some of them fuck themselves up on purpose just to get back to the grind.
It's a really sad thing. You see it all the time. And I have a few friends I can think of where it's like, you convinced yourself that your talent was completely tied to pain. And man, is that sad, because you're a talented person no matter what. So I wish you could just find it in yourself to be happy. It's sad to see. It's sad to have done it. It's sad to see it from the outside too. Just be like, oh, I wish, maybe for some people it's true, but when you see it, when you're sitting at a table with another comic and you both just did a show or something and you see, oh, this person really think it's like Dumbo's feather. It's like you're hanging on to a thing you don't need. Like, you know?
Yeah.
It's sad.
It's hard, but I love that Dumbo's feather. Well, I mean, maybe there's nothing to hang on to at all anyway. I mean, isn't that by the way, you got to go. I know you're on a press tour. It's 5:02.
I can hang out a little while more.
Thank you. When you have kids, time starts moving real fast. Yeah. And your comedy special, Half My Life, I'm assuming you're addressing that reality.
Yes.
Pre-order. And And so are you getting that feeling of like, I'm already dead? Like, this shit's going by so fast anyway. I don't mean like in a gloomy, gothy way. I mean, like, it's a year in, even though this last year felt like a long time, but you know what I mean? That sense of like, damn, the years are starting to go by like telephone poles in a car that's accelerating. You know what I mean? And like, I'm going to blink and it's, this shit's over.
Yes. You
know? Yes. Feather or not, flying or falling, succeeding or failing. It's, I feel like, you know, it's just suddenly you're going to be like, hopefully looking up at your family, you know, and they love you. Not like your family murdering you, which by the way, just saw a Dateline where these kids murdered their fucking mom. You know what I mean? But so yeah, can we? they like ate her, but yeah, I think how mad, they were mad. But yeah, you know, how are you doing with that? How are you doing with all this existential stuff? And how did you work it into your new special?
Well, the bullet points of the special are I shot a tour, 10 venues, all kind of small venues, the types of venues that I actually play on the road when I'm like building that hour and chipping away at it. And I just really love those spaces. And sometimes my show gets, like, I'll go on stage, sometimes things get chaotic, you know, like I've always been that guy. And I managed to get a bunch of footage of that. Like, there's a show in Baltimore where a girl got on stage and was like demonstrating wrestling holds on me, and it was really painful. And like, I'm like, I can't get this stuff like that in a regular special. And I was able to put all this interstitial footage of like all the things we know of, like get into some town too early and you don't know anybody there and you find some dumb way to kill time with your friend who opens for you, and you know, sitting in traffic, and you know, we have this footage that it actually, I feel like it's a very genuine moment. And I watch it, I go, man, that was me with my guard down. I'm like sitting in traffic wondering if I'm gonna make this show in Detroit on time. I just go, I think I still love this, but man, does my back hurt. And I'm like, that's exactly where my head was at when I filmed it. So, you know, having a kid at home, do I still want to go on? All that stuff. So I was able to also have a soundtrack for the special because we did it that way. I was psyched about that. It's a good soundtrack. So
wait, what do you mean? You mean you recorded a soundtrack? Like, people normally don't see that. Is that what you mean?
No, soundtrack. So because we had this So it's like, here's some jokes, here's some stories, and then we're going to cut to another city. So let's throw some travel stuff in between. And then I get these bands who I really like to throw some songs in that footage where I'm like, oh, most comedy specials don't get to have a soundtrack. That's cool, man. And yeah. Some are very small local bands. Some are like much bigger bands in the punk world. And like, felt cool. So I like it. I like it. It's different, just like everything I do, but you might like it. And you're right. So much of it is like, life is moving at a different pace now. I don't want to miss it. Like, the perspective's changed. I've been doing this for 20 years, and now I have a kid, and I don't know. I don't know what to think, just like you and I have been talking about so much today. And the time thing, it's so weird because it's like, not only does it move faster, because you're watching this little human where I go, 3 weeks ago, you weren't who you are now. Like, yeah. This is weird to watch. But then also, I have all these feelings of like, man, my life didn't even start until he was born. Like, yeah. Like, I don't know if you feel the same thing where I'm like,
yes, I do.
Oh, I was I did a lot of stuff I really liked. I lived a pretty cool, like, my obituary is going to be pretty cool. I didn't even know that was the precursor. And this is the main event. I had no idea.
Oh, and like, I love that.
Right? And it's like, and also, like, my whole life, I thought it was, like, me walking this hero's journey trying to prove everybody wrong. And now I'm like, there was nobody. There was nobody was particularly mad at me. Who was I trying to prove wrong? Like, it was this ego thing, and like, there was no hero's journey. I was just trying to get here. And that's again why I like hanging out and mowing the lawn with him, because I go, oh, like, I didn't even, that was all the preamble. And now life feels very real. It's strange. I wish I didn't wait so long. It's very strange.
Well, you know, you don't see a lot of proved them wrong on tombstones, but you see a lot of father.
That's true.
That's what people do. That's what gets on that thing. You don't see a lot of, you should see it, like on my show where I raised a lot of money. Somebody ate a hot dog out of someone's ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, I don't mean to sound maudlin. I'm really inspired by what you just said. I should have wrapped it up there instead of tagging it. But it was some dumb tombstone thing.
I have a tomb. You said it. I really want on my tombstone for it to say, anyone who stands on my grave will be cursed forever. Or like, anyone who stands on my grave will not leave this graveyard alive. Like, to try to start an urban legend. It goes back to working at that magazine about ghosts. And I told my wife that, and she goes, if you insist on doing that, my tombstone's going to be next to yours with an arrow pointing towards yours, and it's just going to say, I'm with stupid. And I was like, that's so good. That's so good. If you sell out my bit on your tombstone, that's so good.
Chris Gethard, thank you so much for your time. You are so funny. Thank you for giving me this time with you. Can you tell people where they can find you?
ChrisGeth.com for all the info, and then I'm on all the socials and the special. You can find it on Apple and Amazon and YouTube and Peacock. It's out a bunch of places, and I have to say, I did not expect this one to cut so deep and be so thoughtful, and it really was a joy. And even just to connect with someone else with a kid the same age who's also a comedian has been rare for me, so it's super cool, and thanks for letting me talk to you.
Thank you, Chris. All the links you need to find Chris's special and books and social media stuff is at DuncanTrussell.com. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
That was Chris Gethard, everybody. Don't forget to listen to his special, Half My Life. That's going to be on all the streaming services. Look out for his tour. All the links you need to find him will be at DuncanTrussell.com. Big thank you to our sponsors, MeUndies, Purple, and Blue Chew. Those offer codes are also going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Do subscribe to the Patreon, won't you? Patreon.com/DTFH. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. I will see you soon. Until then, Hare Krishna.